So we spent a lot of last class setting up our discussion of the ethics, which I said we won't spend too much time on, given that I spend as much time as I do in the second year course and what I hope will be a seminar on the ethics next year. But what we have done is speak quite extensively about the relation between desire and reason, and how all of that comes together in the practical syllogism, which leads to action. So, this we saw from the De Motu, and of course, the original discussion of desire as a faculty is something that we started with in the De Anima. We are now, therefore, in a position to start thinking about Aristotle's ethics. And the focus here will be to see the place of the ethics in the larger Aristotelian worldview. And hopefully, many things that you might have already heard me say in the past will become clearer in context. But the context actually is wider at this starting point, because I think it's important to see that Aristotle's context in general is, of course, Plato, and in the context of his ethics, this is interestingly still true. Even if the distance between the two of them is perhaps not as far here as it is in, say, matters relating to metaphysics and, say, the nature of the forms. But as I said, there are important distinctions nevertheless, and some of these distinctions are really key to seeing what Aristotle is up to in the ethics overall. If you think about Plato in the Republic, one of the things that he does say is that if justice is a relationship between the different parts of the soul, such that each of the parts of the soul have a particular virtue, so appetites have moderation, spirit has courage, and reason has wisdom, then justice is the proper working of all of these three parts of the soul. Justice is the harmony of the soul. Now, the quick and dirty lesson from that is that for Plato, it's very important that you have the right kind of disposition in place. So much so that Aristotle criticizes him in the Ethics for saying that it's possible for Plato to say that the person upon the rack is happy. A view that, interestingly enough, the Stoics agree with, as does the Judeo-Christian tradition. After all, their hero, Jesus Christ, was in fact put upon the rack. So that should in fact be unsurprising. The point is that for Aristotle, it's not enough that the dispositional features of justice be in place. It is really important, in other words, that the dispositional features be actualized. Now, this actualization, as we have seen, comes in terms of activity that follows from having the right kind of a second potentiality or first actuality. And in this case, that would be virtue, something that we have seen in the ethics. Hence, it is unsurprising that he says that happiness is an activity. But the other interesting thing that Aristotle emphasizes is the place of intention, because he thinks it's not just enough that the action simulate virtue, but it's also important that it come from the right kind of disposition, and that it be taken undertaken with the right kind of intentionality as well. So if you put all of this together, then the actualization of potential here is quite complex. It's not simply activity, but it's a certain kind of activity where there's a certain kind of intentionality, where the intentionality, as Aristotle puts it, has to do with the action being undertaken for its own sake, and therefore, in other words, has to do with the fact that the action be an end in itself, so that we have an approximation of an energeia, an activity, as opposed to a process or a kinesis. The other important feature of Aristotle's thinking, broadly construed when it comes to matters ethical, is the fact that he emphasizes so very much that human beings are political animals. That is, it's not simply the case that we can be fully human on our own in the wilderness, off the grid, and so on and so forth. It is very much the case that who we are and what it means to be fully human happens in the context of the state, of the city state, yeah, specifically. So this is, of course, an enormously influential point. It is implicit in Aristotle, in Plato, and in the way in which he develops the Republic. But it's the biological dimensions of this are developed explicitly in Aristotle. Now, what it means then for the human being to live the fully social life, to live the best kind of human life, which he says is the happy life, is very delicate, because it's not simply the case that this can happen in any kind of state. It must be the case that it happens in the good state. And so we'll have to explore what the good state is for Aristotle. But it's also going to be the case that it doesn't happen if you're happen to live in a good state automatically, because it doesn't mean that we can pursue the satisfaction of any kind of desire. But in fact, he thinks we should be trying to satisfy the truly human desires. And of course, this discussion about desire, as I've said in the introduction to this lecture, is continuous with the discussions of desire in the De Anima, which is dealing with the human soul, and therefore with the human species form. So the interesting thing is that in the case of human beings, the expression of species form is not automatic. That isn't to say that it is automatic for a dog or for a tree, because it is the case that the dog and the tree need the relevant kinds of natural context to develop appropriately, as do humans. But the interesting thing is that the human condition is far more delicate, that it takes a lot more when it comes to the actualization of species form proper, when it comes to obtaining or achieving the good life, the happy life in the case of human beings, than it does in the case of say, dogs. And again, you've heard me speak to this issue in the second year course on ethics, perhaps, but now I think you can see how important this is in the context of the discussion of substance in general in Aristotle, because what Aristotle is saying here, and again, this is hugely significant, that human beings don't always get to express what it means to be fully human, perhaps because the environment isn't appropriate, or even if it is, that we don't make it so that we express our species form. And this is very important because implicit in Aristotle is the point about moral responsibility, that if in fact we are to be responsible for our actions, it must be the case that we don't simply develop our form, our species form, our substancehood automatically. If it were the case that it was automatic, we wouldn't be held responsible for who we are in quite the same way. It's precisely because we could go one way or the other. We could become fully human, or we could decide not to. That we are held responsible. And of course, what it means to be fully human, as I've suggested before, involves being virtuous, involves being moral, so that morality is not superfluous, so that virtue is in fact essential to how human beings develop qua human beings in the Aristotelian context. Now, what's interesting about the discussion in Aristotle then is that there's a kind of space that his views lend themselves to us when it comes to determining the true shape and nature of happiness. Broadly speaking, we can say that there are two kinds of readings. There's one kind of reading that emphasizes the social dimension of happiness, and what we might call the practical life, the life of practical virtue, of the political life, whereas the second interpretation emphasizes the place and high importance of philosophy, and therefore of the contemplative life, which Aristotle says in Book 10 is incommensurable, if you will, with the practical life. So this causes all kinds of problems, and I think what we're going to have to try and do is take a middle path, if you will, where we try and reconcile the extremes, and find a view that tries to accommodate both the social and the philosophical in our reading of Aristotle's Ethics.
One of the distinctive things about Book One is the centrality of happiness in its discussions. Very clearly, Aristotle tells us that happiness is the highest human end. And the reasoning for this is pretty straightforward. He says it is the highest human end based on all kinds of considerations that have to do with why we pursue what we pursue. Because whatever it is that we pursue, we can always ask the question, well, why do we do this? And inevitably, the answer at one point or the other is that we do so for the sake of happiness. But we can never ask the question of happiness, why do we pursue happiness? Well, the answer to that is, well, because we want to be happy. And the point, of course, is therefore that for Aristotle, happiness is the highest end precisely because it is endy, precisely because it is not pursued for the sake of any other higher end, whereas every other end is, in fact, pursued in ways that relate to happiness as the highest end. So now we can ask the question, if happiness is the highest end, then how is it related to our discussions so far about species form? Because as we know that for a tiger to live the fullest life of tiger to flourish, which is another word for happiness, it has to sort of express its species form in the fullest sense of the word. So if that is the case, and if happiness is the highest end, is it reasonable to say that when we actually obtain our happiness, that we are in some sense exemplifying our species form to the fullest, where in fact we can say, in other words, that the species form has been actualized? And I think Aristotle's response to this is quite unambiguously yes. And if it is yes, then it turns out that if happiness is the actualization of species form, then happiness is in fact what is good for us. Happiness is the rude health, if you will, that is the case in the tiger in his prime. So some such thing must be the case for us too. If we are truly happy, then in some sense because it's good for us and we're exemplifying our human form to the fullest possible extent. But it is not simply that happiness is good for us, as far as Aristotle is concerned, because the actualization of species form is also, as it turns out, what the good person does. That is, it turns out to be the activities of virtue. So let me put that in a slightly different way. Not only is it the case that happiness, because of its instantiation of species form, turns out to be what is good for us, but it also is the case that what is good for us is exactly what the good person or the virtuous person does. Now, we can ask Aristotle, why is that? Well, his response is reasonably long-winded, but we can begin by suggesting that, well, it has to do with the fact that the actualization of species form has to be something that is distinctive in us, distinctive in general, so that it separates us from the expression of species form in other animals. How do we tell ourselves apart from giraffes and tigers? And of course, Aristotle's response, as we know from 1.7 that we've seen earlier, is that this distinctiveness is a function of the activity of reason. And here, reason is understood both in its theoretical application as well as its practical one. And we saw that this is different again from the activities of making, and in fact forms the three different areas of study that Aristotle divides his thinking up into. Now, even if it is the case that the activities of reason in their practical application are what make us distinctively human, we can still say, well, that's fine, but why must it be the case that these practically rational activities end up being virtuous activities, or what we would call moral activities? The answer to this is actually quite complex, but I'm going to sort of simplify it and suggest that it has to do with the fact that when we say these are practically rational activities, what that means is that in these activities, reason is prioritized. And if reason is prioritized, then because of the nature of reason, it's the universal or the general which has predominance. Whereas to prioritize the non-rational is to prioritize, for Aristotle, the particular, and is to prioritize the bodily. Now, this is, as I said, the short answer to the question, which in fact takes Aristotle 5 books to answer. And we do not have the time to work through the details of this answer, as I've said, because we've done this in the second year course in Intro Ethics. And as I said, I'll do a much more detailed take on this in the fourth year seminar next year. So, onward and upward. So if the activities of practical reason, when in fact reason is predominant, are the activities of virtue, it isn't therefore to deny that when we act from the non-rational, that reason might be involved. So for instance, when we prioritize our bodily needs to the preclusion of everything else, it doesn't mean we can't use our reason in doing so. But it is clearly not what it means then to prioritize reason. It clearly is not what we mean when we say that we determine what is good for us rationally, and it's based on reason then that we pursue the goods of food and sex. So in the process of this discussion, as I said, which takes up so much of the first half of the Nicomachean Ethics, Aristotle also makes clear that these virtues that he discusses are not just moral, but they are political. That is, he's not simply talking about a moral life in isolation from the political one. In fact, he thinks that they're very closely intertwined, that it is often difficult to tell them apart. So, for instance, to use the example of temperance again, temperance is the virtue that is concerned with food and sex. And in this instance, what we do is we prioritize our reason over our appetites. And we need to do this not just for our mental and physical health, which is therefore a personal or a moral consideration, but it also has political overtones because it is the basis of not overreaching or overrunning others. It is the basis, in other words, for being able to live with each other in a certain kind of way. Without it, it might be difficult, for instance, to maintain the possibility of private property. Similarly, courage is reason over fear. It's when we stand for what we believe in, and usually in the Aristotelian context, it has to do with standing with the state against its enemies, although we might use that term less politically and far more in the context of, say, standing up for what we believe in. So again, we can see that the moral and political dimensions, at least for Aristotle, are very closely intertwined. Wisdom is the regulation of one's life in general, which I mean practical wisdom, or he calls phronesis, and wherein he's speaking of one's life as a citizen, as a private citizen, sort of organizing the activities of your household in a reasonable fashion, which mirrors, Aristotle thinks, what the politician does for the state. And in fact, the citizen and the politician are not different people, because in his ideal state, at the very least, every citizen takes their turn to rule. So the moral and political life, the upshot, is the actualization of reason in practical form, and therefore an actualization of a part of our function as rational beings. Because remember, as I said, there's practical reason and theoretical reason, and these virtues, and which constitute our practical life and our political life, therefore constitute one part of that. So the moral and political life then is the actualization of reason, and to this extent the actualization of a part of human form or species form, because it is, as we've said, a part of our function. What makes us distinctive is our reason, and so to actualize the moral life, the political life, is to actualize our function to a certain extent. Now, insofar as we do this, what we're actualizing is a part of the final end of happiness. And Aristotle's point here, I think, is quite clear, that insofar as we live the moral and political life, that constitutes happiness. It's not simply a means to happiness. It is very much a part of it, and it is a part of it because it is the actualization of human function that is rational. It's not just the case that this is something that is the case from the outside, where we can see this as constituting human happiness, but it must also be the case from the inside. That is, it must be the case that these activities, as understood as virtuous activities, must be undertaken because they're virtuous, precisely because they are virtuous. And this has interesting and important connotations, or implications, I mean, because this is part of what's going to allow these activities to be energei, or activities as opposed to processes or kinesis. And the important discussion of pleasure that we will have next class will make that connection even more obvious. The problem is that it is because these activities are practical, they're applications of practical reason, as we've seen, both in the moral and political dimensions of our lives, because it is that, it has political, practical outcomes, such as in the moral realm, health, psychical or physical, or victory, or the just distribution of goods in the political realm. So even though these actions are undertaken for their own sake, it's also the case that they have these kinds of practical outcomes. And because they have these practical outcomes that ultimately procure, Aristotle thinks, the leisure necessary for other rational activities like philosophy, other rational activities that are purely theoretical in nature, activities that do not have outcomes of this sort that practical reason does, that he's going to want to say that these then are the highest form of happiness. Because remember, as we started off, the point that he wants to make is happiness is never undertaken for any other reason than itself. And that then ends up being the case only for the activities of theoretical reason and not for the activities of practical reason or practical virtue, which is why the activities of practical virtue end up being called a secondary form of happiness. So far then, we have seen how reason has application in the practical arena. And now it's time to turn our attention very quickly to reason's application in the theoretical arena. Now, much of this we have already seen. It's clear in the study of physics, and we, as we will see later in metaphysics, there's an extension of the theoretical use of reason. It is also the case that when we study the human soul, or when we study you know, plants, that we use theoretical reason. But then we may ask, why is it the case that the theoretical study of ethics, art, and economics are not applications of theoretical reason? And Aristotle's response to this is that it's partly got to do with the fact that practical sciences have to do with practical life. That is, the emphasis in those areas of study, including ethics, is not on methodology. The emphasis is very much on the nature of the objects studied. So the focus then is, as he says in Book 6 of the Nicomachean Ethics, where we divide the intellect into the theoretical and practical based on the objects that they're concerned with. The practical is concerned with varying objects and with the varying nature of the objects, which is why he says you can only have an outline of matters ethical. You can't come up with the kind of definition that you can when you're studying unvarying objects. So the upshot of this is that theoretical objects are characterized by unvaryingness, and this in some sense makes them better objects. And if you sort of pause here and ask the question, well, why is that? Then the response to that has to be something that harkens back to Plato and Plato's views about the forms. That knowledge is unchanging, and if knowledge is unchanging, then so must its objects be. And so we know where that went as far as the forms are concerned, and this then is Aristotle's take on it, that there are certain kinds of practical subjects that do not lend themselves to giving us knowledge of unvarying form. And therefore, to this extent, they do not belong in the theoretical domain. So we've seen that form for Aristotle is unchanging, and by which we mean not the form as it is manifest in the life of Tiger, as much as we mean the cognitional aspect of form, that we get at, theoretically speaking, after observing the life of Tiger in all of its instances. So the point seems to be that form can be unchanging, what we mean by the definition of Tiger, for instance, even though what it means to be Tiger is constantly changing. So Aristotle's point, I think, is therefore quite consistent. The unchanging form of changing objects is higher than the changing form of changing objects. For example, of practical objects, such as what is virtuous action in a particular context, which, as we know, is a function of the mean and can be quite variable. So, therefore, it follows that unchanging form of unchanging objects is higher than the unchanging form of changing objects. In other words, if the unchanging form of changing objects is higher than the changing form of changing objects, then it must be the case that the unchanging form of unchanging objects is even higher. But even this needs to be qualified, because there it is often the case that theoretical study has practical application. For instance, the study of astronomy can help us better determine the nature of the seasons and their timing and so on and so forth. So if that is the case, then even though these objects are to a larger extent less changeful and therefore of a higher ontological standing than changing objects in the world, because they have the study of them has a practical application, theoretical study per se is not what Aristotle means by the highest use of theoretical reason. Aristotle says that the highest manifestation of happiness, the highest activity of happiness, is the contemplation of the highest theoretical objects. We may ask, why? Why does he say this? In other words, what Aristotle, I think, is saying is that theoretical pursuits, insofar as they have practical application, are not the do not constitute the highest satisfaction or the highest activities of reason, because what it means to be a human being is to want to know, and it is in satisfying that desire that we obtain happiness to the fullest extent. That is, while it is nice that knowledge has practical applications, because it helps us survive, for instance, this is not key to the fulfillment of our nature. It is key to the survival of our nature, but it isn't key to the fulfillment of our nature. That fulfillment, Aristotle says, happens when we know simply for the sake of knowing. That is, when we undertake an activity that is an end in itself in the fullest sense of the word, which only happens in contemplation. Contemplation is the activity, in other words, of looking at what we know and delighting in this without any other motive, especially practical motives. So you can see that this again may sound strange to our ears, because we are so intent on the journey and the benefits that we derive from the journey of reason, whereas Aristotle seems to be focused very much on the destination, and it has so much to do with the fact that happiness, again, is the most endy of things, and if it's the most endy of things, there seem to be varying degrees of endiness culminating in this highest of activity, which has no other end other than itself. So happiness, the upshot of all of this, is in the full sense of the life of happiness, includes the practical and theoretical activities that we undertake as citizens and scientists and artists, activities that are only possible in a state where there is leisure. But the capstone of such a life that is essential for happiness to be complete in the fullest sense lies for Aristotle in the activity of contemplation.